When it gets that quiet, that can only mean one thing. All right, Judges chapter 9. We're going to finish here today. And I'll have a couple things to say before we get started in our text, which we'll do that after a word of prayer. Brother Butler, if you would lead us in a prayer to open us in class, please. Just to kind of bring us up to speed, Judges chapter 9, we were reading the story of Abimelech. What's happened in the last, or first 21 verses of the story, you've got Abimelech, who was the son of Gideon and a harlot from the land of Shechem. He went to the men of Shechem and said, it'd be better if one man reigned over you than 70 men. And so he receives a sponsorship to go and to kill each of his brothers, all 70 of them. So he thought. As it turned out, the youngest brother by the name of Jotham escaped. And Jotham made a statement to the men of Shechem. Remember that statement he made from Mount Gerizim? And you have that kind of amphitheater where he was able to speak from over a mile away and yet be heard by the people of the city. And so he told this parable about this, the various trees looking for a ruler, and the fig tree wouldn't rule over them, and the olive tree wouldn't rule over them. They finally settled on the bramble because they just wanted to be ruled so badly. And so he says, if you've dealt fairly with the sons with Gideon and his family for what he's done for you, then good for you. But if not, then Abimelech's going to give you what you deserve, and he's going to get what he deserves too. So that's essentially the first 21 verses as they occurred to us. Let's pick up in verse 22. Read the next portion of the story after Jotham escaped and fled. 22 through verse 33. Brother Collier, would you read that text for us, please? All right, thank you, John. We'll stop right there. All right, so we see here divine intervention. One of the reasons the book of Judges probably isn't as well known is because it's got challenging texts that you just have to deal with. It presents things about God that aren't easy to reconcile sometimes with what people would say the nice God or describe as the nice God of the New Testament. But we understand God's consistent in his nature. And this is one of the things that we may come to and others may look at, and they may look at this text and they may struggle with it. And that's why sometimes we just learn the stories, but we don't really learn the details of the event. Verse 23 tells us that God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. So divine intervention. Maybe Abimelech and Shechem were getting on too well. What we're going to find out is the leader and the people were kind of cut from the same cloth. They're both kind of sorry, low-down, robbing, thieving, murdering folks. That's just the whole lot of them. And maybe they were doing pretty good with Abimelech at his helm. But remember, God wants to punish the people, and he wants to punish Abimelech for what he's done. So maybe they were just rubbing along too good, and God said, you know, I'm going to step in and intervene and make sure these men and Abimelech get what they deserve. So verse 23, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And so what the narrator makes clear in this passage is this was God's judgment and causes us, I think, probably to scratch our head because it may not reconcile with some of the things we think about God too easily. So let's just consider this question. Question number 7, if you're following along. What can we conclude about God's use of an evil spirit in verse 23? Any comments you want to make about the evil spirit, God using it? We're welcome at this time.
Well, we really can't understand fully God's ways, but he chose to do that. To send an evil spirit to cause that whatever happened.
But Barker? You can help or you can get out of the way. And it's going to have lasting impacts on what happens to us after our life is over. Can you think of any other instances where God used evil spirits?
Yes, King Saul.
Okay, King Saul. Remember, whenever Saul was essentially removed from the throne by God, God says, you're not going to be the king anymore. And David's anointed. We're told that God sent an evil spirit on Saul. And it caused him to be moody, caused him to be depressed, and it caused him to turn murderous against David, one of his best soldiers, and against even his own son Jonathan to that degree. And so we don't know how exactly it happened, but that evil spirit was just like a rain cloud over Saul, just changed his personality. And so he took a lot of wrong turns after that. That was coming from the hand of God. I'll tell you another instance is when God sent a lying spirit to Ahab, and I think that may be found in 1 Chronicles. Maybe it's in 2 Kings, where God wants Ahab to go to war. And as Dave said, God's going to judge sin, and he's going to do it in his time. God wanted Ahab to go to war. Ahab was going to die in this war. And so he said, you know, Micaiah, who's the prophet, paints this heavenly scene saying, you know, God's there and says, who will go and be a lying spirit in the mouth of the prophets to send Ahab to war? And so this idea of God using evil spirits, it may not really get along too well with some of perhaps our perceptions about God as we understand him in the New Testament. We think the angels are the workers of God, accomplishing God's purposes. But as Dave says, God's goal is going to be achieved. And what I gather from this is that God's got power over the angels that choose to obey, and the good angels, if we will, and then the wicked ones as well. He's got ultimate. Yeah, they may serve Satan, but God has control over them too, you know, regardless of the fact that they've chose Satan. Let's turn over 2 Thessalonians 2 real quick, and this is about as close as we're going to get of an interpretation or a reappearance of this idea about God using evil spirits. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 11 and 12. We have in that passage, if you reject God and you reject God and you reject God, it's going to get to a point where God's going to wash his hands of you. For this reason, 2 Thessalonians 2, looking at verses 11 and 12, God will send upon them a deluding influence. That's how the New American Standard addresses it, so that they will believe what is false, in order that they may be judged, who did not believe the truth but took pleasure in unwickedness. So you've got God sending this deluding influence. What other translations, what other terms are used for deluding influence?
Strong delusions.
That's the one I'm most familiar with from King James and New King James. Any others? Something along that? Strong delusions is the one I was looking for.
ESV is a strong delusion.
Okay. So, you know, this idea that God would delude somebody so that they might be punished? Well, we're dealing with people here that... we're not dealing with good people here. You know, verse 12 tells us we're dealing with people took pleasure in wickedness. Ahab was of the sort. Saul was of the sort. And Abimelech and the people of Shechem were of the sort. So we see also the type of person that God exercises this supernatural influence, at least as it's described in the Old Testament, if you will, where he uses this evil spirit to cause friction between Shechem and between their king Abimelech. And so we got here, as we read through in the text, what the men of Shechem do is they start ambushing robbers, taking their things. And these folks from Shechem, we really learn a lot about them here. You know, they were willing to give the money to Abimelech so that he could go and kill his brothers. Now they're rebelling against Abimelech, and they're robbing people that are trying to travel through the land of Shechem, and they're harming them. They're thieves, they're murderers, and they're rebels, and they've got the chief thief, murderer, and rebel at their helm as well. So word does get back to Abimelech. And this is where we see another man entering the scene in verse 26, a man by the name of Gaal, I guess is how you pronounce that. And what he does is he gains the trust of the men of Shechem. So they have this party to celebrate Gaal's arrival in the house of Baal-Berith. Remember, that's the god the flavor of the god that they chose to go after this time. And this is what God's going to use as a tool to judge both Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And he gets drunk and he starts spouting off. Once again, this is just kind of the effects alcohol has on you. It kind of emboldens you. And so during the celebration of the people of Shechem, Gaal's come to town. He starts spouting off some of the things that he's going to do. You know, let Abimelech send his army out against me. You know, I would deal with them. And here's his claim to fame. Notice this, it's the same claim that Abimelech made, wasn't it? Remember, Abimelech goes to the people of Shechem and says, "Hey, my mother was a Shechemite. These people, these other sons of Gideon, they're not your blood. They're not your kin. Wouldn't you rather have kin ruling over you than these foreigners, these people who aren't from Shechem?" And so he uses that incentive of being related to them and having this kinship in common with them to undo the family of Gideon. Well, that's what we have here, the claim of this man by the name of Gaal. His claim was also familial as well. In fact, he one-ups Abimelech. Abimelech was only kin to the Shechemites through his mother, who was a harlot there. This guy seemed to be a member of the founding family. And so he had an even stronger tie to these Shechemites, going all the way back to where the Shechemites originated. He has a closer, more solid tie-in than Gideon did. He goes all the way back and he fits in with his family. So obviously their loyalty swings to this new guy. But he uses the same argument that Abimelech did. So in his drunken state, he makes these boasts against Abimelech, who for whatever reason is not present, to come out against him. And then Zebul, who is Abimelech's right-hand man, he hears all of this going on. He's starting to see what's happening. He understands what's about to take place, how the favor of the people were going after this man named Gaal rather than Abimelech, and their loyalty is being lost there. So he covertly informs Abimelech of this uprising that's taking place, and he suggests a battle plan. You go out, you hide in the fields at night, you come out and you fight when the sun's up. And that's where the reading concludes. Anybody want to make any comments on that text? All right, let's look at verses 34 through 41. And we may make it through chapter 9. I may have a thing or two to say about chapter 10 if we can get over there in time. We'll just shoot for finishing with chapter 9. Verses 34 through 41. Brother Barker, would you read that, please? 34 through 41.
Shadows of the mountains as if they were men. God spoke again and said, "Behold, people are coming down from the highest part of the land,
All right, so this is a relatively straightforward text. I don't have just a whole lot to say. It's just part of the narrative of the story. You know, in the morning, it seems like Abimelech listens to Zebul, who's giving him this advice to, you know, lay low in the fields. I didn't really understand the advice. I thought it might have been better to come in by night while this drunken rave was taking place. And I imagine Gaal and his men probably would have been a whole lot easier to defeat in that drunken state. Maybe he wanted to wait until they were hungover and said, well, you know, just wait to let them finish their party, and you can come in the morning and you can run Gaal and them out of town. So they finish their celebration. Abimelech and his men, they hide out there on the outskirts of the city. Morning comes. These men are probably suffering from their overindulgence in the alcohol. And Gaal sees them coming. And he says to Zebul, you know, there's people that are coming from far away. And he says, no, you're seeing things, man. You're hungover. That's not an army coming. And he gets closer and he realizes it is. And then, you know, Zebul, who's probably been waiting to say this, is like, okay, you're about to get your wish. It's Abimelech. He's coming. What are you going to do? And so they engage in this battle. Gaal and his men are defeated by Abimelech. And he kind of reclaims his throne in Shechem. But Abimelech's a pretty bad guy. He's not done with these people yet. He's going to have more to say to them. Anybody want to comment on any of the events there in those few verses? All right, so he reclaims his throne, and let's see what happens if they just settle down and kind of restore order as it was before they left. Let's look at verses 42 through 49. See, who wouldn't mind reading that for us? Steve, would you read Judges 9, 42 through 49 for us, please? So it seems like things are about to get back to normal. We're not looking at the rebels. Remember, the rebels are the ones that were hiding in the mountain passes and ambushing people that were traveling by and robbing them. We're looking at a totally different group of people. These are the civilians of the town of Shechem. They get up. They get ready to go back to work. They probably didn't even know about the party that had passed the night before. So they're the common folk that are looking to resume their everyday life. But Abimelech is a spiteful guy. He's kind of shown himself to be pretty sorry already in what he did to his brothers. He has no love for his kin. Obviously, here he's going to demonstrate no love for his people as well. And so he and his people, they lie in wait for them. They kill just the residents of the city. And after doing so, they take salt and spread it all over the ground. First thought about that is, well, they're trying to render the land useless. They put salt there. Nothing will ever grow again. And so essentially they're just washing their hands of the city. Some of the commentators I read said, well, not all salt just removes the fertility of the land. So depending on the kind of salt that was put down, what they may have been doing, and what you'll remember, salt is a purifying agent. It's a consecrating agent. And so what they thought they might have been doing was, rather than trying to just destroy the land completely, is that they were consecrating it again, perhaps in an attempt to later start over and to rebuild at some point in time in the future. Perhaps it was a consecration act. Perhaps it was them trying to just lay waste to the land and say, you're never coming back again for what you did to me. Not 100% certain about that. But there are some things that we can gather about Abimelech's actions against the people. What do we find out about this guy that we've really seen earlier on? As if you look at how he treats this people that he was king over.
He wasn't loyal to anyone except
Pretty good point. Pretty good observation. He wasn't loyal to anybody but himself. And he showed that earlier on with his brothers. I mean, if you'll commit such an atrocious act against somebody that's related to you, why would he have any loyalty to these people? And so that's just a lack of loyalty there. Interesting you use that word. That's the same word that you used to describe the men that Abimelech went out and hired, the thugs he essentially went out and hired to kill his brothers. They were described as worthless and reckless men. Just nothing redeeming about them. Nothing good about them. And so we're looking here, pretty wicked guys. Obviously very prideful. That's what I kind of thought. You know, he'd run the army out that had opposed him. He had destroyed the people that were causing the disruption. But that wasn't enough for him. And so he's going to go a step beyond that. He's going to take his anger out on, perhaps, and maybe they're not as innocent as they seem, and I would assume not, because part of the reason that God sent that evil spirit was so that Shechem would be destroyed and so that Abimelech would be destroyed. And so as these just regular old residents of Shechem are getting ready to go to work, he's going to go to war on them. He's going to wage war on the men of Shechem, and he's going to destroy them to a man, essentially. So he's prideful, he's distrustful, he sought vengeance. Maybe he's thinking, if I can't be your king, nobody's going to be your king. So he just completely does everything he can to wipe these people off the face of the earth. In verses 46 through 49, they realize what's starting to happen. They flee to their last resort, this fortified tower in the city of Shechem. So Abimelech and his men, they go up to Mount Zalmon. Not really sure where that is geographically. Probably a hill or a mountain, very close proximity to the land of Shechem and the tribe of Manasseh. They get down trees and they stack them up against the tower and they burn the tower to the ground, killing about 1,000 men and women. So Jotham's words are starting to come to pass. Remember I said they were a bit prophetic. Whenever it said, fire's going to come out of the bramble and devour you, well, very literally, that's what happened at the hands of Abimelech. Fire was the means of destruction through which the people of Shechem were punished as they were consumed. So while his hateful actions, they were God's judgment on Shechem for what they had done to Gideon's family, Abimelech himself has yet to reap the consequences of his actions. That's what we're going to read about as we conclude this story. Kyle, would you read verses 50 through 57 for us as Judges 9? Thank y'all for reading that. So the story here concludes. You've got the assault and the disaster at Thebes. Having just destroyed his capital city, Shechem, maybe he's trying to kind of expand his reign. I don't know if he was going after Thebes because of some affiliation with Shechem. But it's thought that Thebes was probably a little satellite city that was outside of Shechem, maybe some little smaller area. And so he goes to Thebes and told you at the beginning of chapter 9 we're going to come across this unnamed woman that had a crush on Abimelech, and we see how that kind of came into being. So after he takes the city, he seeks out this tower, this fortress that was similar to the one at Shechem, and he thinks, okay, well, we're just going to do the same thing that we did at Shechem. We're going to burn this tower to the ground. And so he attempts to do the same thing as well. However, this time we find out It ends up a little bit differently from this unnamed woman. We don't know who she is. Up on top of the tower, she takes this upper millstone, throws it down, hits Abimelech in the head, crushes his skull. And so he says to his sword bearer, you know, kill me so that it can't be said Abimelech is killed by one. Once again, there's that element of pride. You know, he was dying, but yet he cared enough about his reputation to say, don't let it be said Abimelech died at the hands of a woman, something that would have brought disgrace, further disgrace on him after he was gone. And so his sword bearer ran him through, killed him, and then peace begins to ensue. Cut off the head and the body dies. That really puts an end to the rebellion. So let me just show you this image real quick so you kind of have an idea of what you're looking at. I'm sure this isn't from the time of that, but just to give you an idea of what the upper millstone was, they put corn or some other grain inside of the lower stone there, and then they'd have this bigger stone that they would roll around and kind of crush the corn or the grain and then have meal as a result of that. And so when you're looking at talking about the upper millstone, you're looking at a rock that probably weighed 30 to 45 pounds, just depending on the size. Being thrown from the top of a tower, you can imagine what would happen, you know, if it hits a man in the head. And so that was the means by which Abimelech met his end. This upper millstone's cast down. And upon seeing the army or the leader destroyed, what they then do, the army disperses and solutions kind of resolved. It's really the story of two women with Abimelech. His life began as he was the result of a relationship between Gideon and this harlot, the woman that gave him life, and it came to end at this unnamed woman threw this millstone out from this tower at Thebes, crushed his head, and ended up taking his life. So we see in verse 57, God's only mentioned here twice, but this is one of the places where he is. God returned all the wickedness on the men of Shechem and on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. And so fire came out and destroyed the people of Shechem for their ingratitude to Gideon and to his family. And we also see that the words of Jotham were fulfilled whenever Abimelech himself was punished, because Abimelech dealt very unfairly with the people of Gideon. And so he meets his end here as well. And that was God that was behind that. God sending that evil spirit, God causing that distress between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and then finally God taking the life of this man through the woman that cast down that millstone and essentially gave him a death sentence. All right. Does anyone want to make any comments on chapter 9? Any questions? Anything we left unresolved? What are some of the things you kind of walk away with as you read this story? Some application we can make today? Judgment's going to come on those that are evil, and God's going to be the one to bring it about. We need to make sure we're not going to be on the side of those who are being judged.
I think it's also, when you think about how these, I always think about the guy that pulled back the arrow and just let it fly.
Ahab. Just don't know. But Stanton?
That would be considered an upper millstone. Is that bottom of the lower millstone?
I guess that.
The faster one, you know, it's about to be better than a millstone hanging around your neck and the arm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the imagery that it would have called to mind. Either one of those, you know. You strap that around somebody's neck. I don't know how long, if you throw somebody in the water, even with that top one, 45 pounds, you know, around somebody's neck, and that thing's just trying to make its way to the bottom. But that bottom one, you're definitely dead. I don't care how good of a swimmer you might be. But that top one, you know.
I don't see how he was able to put a sword through
him. Maybe it kind of just glanced, you know, glanced off his head. You'd think if that thing hit head on, all you'd see probably was just a bunch of gray matter. But it must have glanced off his head, or she must not have had a solid hit or something. Anyway, he was able to say, hey, to a swordsman, you know, take my
life.
Is that what it says?
Yeah.
What verse does that remind me of? Okay. Mine just says through an upper millstone. And so if King James is a little more correct on the interpretation there, which it very well may be, then you could cut a chunk out of that rock. And, you know, if you throw it from a high place, it's going to gain velocity going down. It's going to do some damage. Something like that, you'd think it would just obliterate a man's skull if it were to hit him. He did. Yeah, with a small round stone. And so perhaps it was just a piece of a millstone that had broken off that they found, and she was throwing down the projectile and just hit him. All right, Dave, were you going to say something? And then Johnny?
It's funny that he tried to avoid being classed as being killed by a woman, and he wanted to avoid that having him killed by a woman. And he wanted to avoid them having him run through with a sword, but even Jewish history records, because you hear King David refer to him as, hey, why did you get so close to the wall? Didn't you, don't you remember Abimelech?
That's right. You're right. Example of poor military tactics. Johnny? You think about all the harm that was done through breaking from God's plan, you know, from the beginning for marriage. I think we talked about that a little bit earlier on, and especially that relationship between the half-siblings. That's what Gideon or Abimelech was to the sons of Gideon. He was half brother to these men, but it's because Gideon strayed and, you know, had this relationship with his concubine and Shechem. And then his name just kind of baffles me. My son is king. You know, I don't know what he had in mind for this half son. Maybe he was partial to him for some reason over all of his other sons, but he gives him this name, my son is king.
Abimelech,
I guess just normally they're passed down from the patriarchal, you know. Yeah. The we never find out his mother's name is Shechem. You go read the genealogies and it's like the son of, the son of, the son of, the son of. Very, very rarely do you have someone, you know, a female mentioned in the genealogies. I guess it's just that the patriarchal mindset. That's how they chased their lineage back, was through through their fathers, you know. But son of Jerubbaal, son of Gideon. You know, Gideon was his father, but one of Gideon's wives wasn't his mother. And so, you know, he had that tie-in with Gideon, but that relationship with his brothers wasn't very good. And so that was Gideon's breaking from God's plan for marriage, committing adultery with that harlot. And as a result of that, the consequences were very, very severe. All right, we'll pick up in chapter 10 next week. I'm glad we made it through 9. Questions are in the back if you want to grab those. They're also online if you prefer to grab them there. So thank everybody for their attention and their participation in our classes.